arrested at the scene. By remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So yes, a young person may contract the virus and be asymptomatic, but you and I know very well that they're going back into communities where they might live with a grandmother, they might live with a vulnerable citizen.
That's Mamusi Maimane, leader of the One South Africa movement, on efforts to ensure the country's schools are safe amid efforts to reclose them due to COVID-19. Details coming up also. Two separate explosions in the last 24 hours kills seven people in Somalia. And tomorrow's presidential election rerun in Malawi, according to the country's electoral commission, will be free and fair. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A Heritage Foundation report says Chinese building projects in Africa could be a possible vector for espionage. VOA Salem Salomon spoke to the author of the report and has the details.
A report by the Heritage Foundation is warning that China may be spying on African government officials from within their own buildings. The U.S.-based conservative think tank found that Chinese companies built at least 186 government buildings in Africa and 14 sensitive telecommunications networks. These buildings include residences of heads of state, parliamentary offices, and police and military headquarters. The author of the report, Joshua Mzervi, senior policy analyst for Africa at the Heritage Foundation, said the research does not prove there is spying going on at these buildings, but he believes the possibility should be explored.
The Chinese government has a long history of all types of surveillance and espionage globally. So we know this is the sort of thing they want to do, the sort of thing they have the capacity to do. And also Africa is important enough to them to do it.
Mzervi noted that private Chinese companies are legally obliged to help the Chinese Communist Party gather intelligence. But during a May press conference, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhou Lijian strongly denounced the report, saying it is filled with lies, illusions, and ideological bias. In a written remark, the spokesperson said, "We urge a certain think tank in the U.S. to spend more time and energy on assisting Africa with real actions instead of spreading lies. The African people have a fair judgment. Attempts to drive a wedge between the friendly partners of China and Africa will only lead to self-inflicted humiliation." Mzervi said the idea for the report came from a 2018 accusation that China had installed listening devices in the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The findings, first published by the French newspaper Le Monde, alleged that servers in the AU headquarters were secretly sending data to a computer system in Shanghai each night. AU and Chinese officials denied the Le Monde report. But Mzervi says China's motives for investing so heavily in building infrastructure for African governments are suspect, since these projects generally are not profitable.
For decades, China, central element of its international diplomatic efforts have been cultivating strong relationships with senior African officials and giving them glitzy, brand new government buildings is clearly a way of building favor with these governments. So clearly these are designed as pieces of political influence.
The Heritage Foundation report found that Chinese companies had built at least 24 African presidential or prime ministerial palaces, residences or offices, and at least 26 parliaments or parliamentary offices.
It's possible to gather information on specific leaders, learn about their habits, their predilections, their financial situation, things that you could use to manipulate them or even to recruit them as an asset, if either through blackmail or just knowing how to tailor your pitch to them.
Mzervi added, China may be interested in gathering financial data on African countries for future investments and to gain the upper hand in loan negotiations. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Malawi's Electoral Commission has said it is confident tomorrow's presidential election rerun will be free and fair and won't see a repeat of last year's irregularities. We saw the re-election of President Peter Mutharika annulled. Mutharika is running against two other candidates, including opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera. Malawi's political analysts say the race is too close to call. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Electoral Commission Chairperson Chifundo Kachale told reporters in a televised press conference Sunday that preparations for the polls has been smooth.
We are glad to report that generally the process went on smoothly, and the commission is very grateful to all the stakeholders for the cooperation and harmonious spirits that prevailed during the whole process. Whatever issues may have arisen were able to be handled harmoniously.
However, Kachale acknowledged that COVID-19 forced the commission to curtail some of its usual election preparation activities.
Of course, with the coming in of COVID-19 pandemic, the commission has been forced to abandon some of the publicity strategies for public outreach, like meetings with traditional leaders, because these have a tendency to bring together a lot of people to one place, which can make the observance of physical distancing difficult at times.
The fresh polls come 4 months after the country's constitutional court annulled last year's elections over massive irregularities, a decision which the Supreme Court of Appeal upheld in May. Rights campaigners who were leading street protests against last year's results say they are confident that Tuesday's polls will be free, fair, and credible. President Mutharika appointed a new team to the Electoral Commission early this month after former chairperson Jane Ansah resigned and mandates expired for the other commissioners. Charles Kajoloweka is the executive director for a local NGO, the Youth and Society Organization. He spoke to VOA via a messaging application.
And it is also inspiring that the current commission have the leadership that seems to, you know, send a strong message that we are here to manage elections better than ever before. And with that confidence that we are seeing in the leadership and the engagement that they're doing, the transparency that they're demonstrating, we should be able to have credible elections.
Although there are three candidates, Tuesday's election is largely between President Mutharika and his main rival, Lazarus Chakwera. During last year's disputed polls, Mutharika got 38% of the vote, while Chakwera came in a close second with 35%. The Constitutional Court ordered that the winner of the Tuesday's elections must amass more than 50% of the valid votes. This forced President Mutharika, leader of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, to form alliance with the opposition United Democratic Front, whose leader Atupere Muluzi came fourth with 5% of the vote during the annulled polls. Chakwera, leader of the Malawi Congress Party, formed an alliance with 9 other opposition parties, including the United Transformation Movement, whose leader, Vice President Saulos Chilima, got 20% of the vote in the annulled election. Both Chakwera and Mutharika told their supporters during their final campaign rallies Saturday that they are confident of winning this time around. However, a recent survey by Institute of Public Opinion and Research showed Chakwera with a 20-point lead. Political analyst Sherifi Kaisi told VOA Monday that the game remains unpredictable because both candidates have massive supporters from rural areas where over 80% of the population lives.
Probably the upper hand would be the one who is going to control the regions, for example. So we have the southern region, which has got 13 districts, and we have the central region with 9 districts, and finally 5 districts from the northern region. So the one who controls a larger part of the regions definitely is going to carry the day.
Mutharika comes from the southern region, while Chakwera comes from the central region. For Tuesday's election, MEC said it will use last year's voters' roll, in which about 7 million Malawians registered to vote. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Two separate explosions moments apart in Somalia killed 7 people over the weekend. The deputy governor of Lower Shabelle, Ahmed Yusuf, tells VOA that the deadliest attack took place in the town of Wanaliwain, 90 kilometers west of Mogadishu. He says attackers exploded a device near the home of a military officer. Moments later, Yusuf said a second explosion went off as people gathered at the scene of the first blast. The deputy governor has told VOA suspects have been arrested and an investigation is going on. Militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for both attacks, which came as Somalia prepares for elections in less than 7 months. Tackling corruption, reviving the economy, rebuilding Somalia's national army, and fighting Al-Shabaab have been the main issues. South African civil society groups and education unions are pressuring their government to close schools as the COVID-19 pandemic begins to peak in some areas. 5,000 new infections were registered Saturday, the highest yet, raising the country's total to almost 100,000. Almost 2,000 people have died. The government reopened schools to a few grades about a week ago. Darren Taylor reports.
Musi Maimane leads the One South Africa movement. He wants the courts to use special supervisors to make sure that each school in the country has the means to protect youngsters from COVID-19.
All schools must be safe, otherwise you end up in an environment upon which infections are rising. And what we're seeing in South Africa, more and more schools are shutting down because simply the school hasn't got the capability of looking after the very people that are gathering at that particular school.
The schools are shutting again because they don't have personal protective equipment or PPE, such as masks for the children or chemicals to deep clean their buildings.
The schools must be closed, obviously, so that we can make sure that the preparations are done. I have done an oversight over a number of schools and gone even one to last week, where when we got there, it became very clear that the school is not ready. They didn't have enough PPEs, they didn't have enough water and sanitation, the toilets were dysfunctional.
The government says only a few schools are not COVID ready, and that's not enough to justify closing all schools. Elijah Mhlanga is spokesman for the Basic Education Department.
There are rural schools, there are areas around the country where there's absolutely no confirmed case and they have all the basics in place, water, sanitation, sanitizers. They are observing all the regulations and you ask them, should you close? And then they'll ask why, because we have everything in place. So
Mhlanga says the state has decided to reopen most of the economy, and that includes schools.
You can't send adults to work and you say the kids must stay at home. It does not make sense. We are seeing children leaving the home with a mask. They get to school, they get given a mask, and they're staying safe. We should just maintain that and stop complaining.
The government argues schools must stay open because science has shown that young people are much less likely to become very ill and die of COVID-19. Maimane says this assertion is disingenuous.
So yes, a young person may contract the virus and be asymptomatic. But you and I know very well that they're going back into communities where they might live with a grandmother, they might live with a vulnerable citizen in this instance. And we simply are creating a way upon which the virus can be communicable from one environment to the next. The risk isn't just what happens in the classroom, it's also what these young people end up doing when they go back into their communities.
Maimane says pupils with coronavirus will also pass it to their teachers, creating another cycle of infection. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As Morocco is planning a phased opening after a 3-month-old coronavirus lockdown, people have a range of concerns and unanswered questions about the medical situation and the decline in tourism, which makes up a considerable portion of the country's economy. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi discussed these concerns with Elizabeth Mayers, a U.S. law professor living in Morocco and founding editor of Inside Arabia News.
People, when the announcement came out the other day, were extremely upset at the lack of information that they're getting. There was especially a public outcry in intellectual circles that I noticed on social media, because there's little rationale or even an inkling on what the debate has been as to how we're going forward, and it's really causing a lot of confusion. People need answers. People want to know, especially when the international borders will open up, because tourism is one of the primary drivers of the Moroccan economy. There's been a problem of stranded foreigners here in Morocco. There's also a problem of stranded Moroccans around the world. There are still stranded Moroccans in America that they don't know what's happening. And so there's so much information that's lacking. When tourism can resume, what's happened with the massive multi-billion dollar COVID-19 fund that was established by King Mohammed Saidis in March. People have questions. Some places that had expected money are not getting money. So where is that money going? There should also have been a massive public awareness campaign to educate the public about the how and the why of the transmission of the virus. But instead, the government mostly focused in vague terms about complying with the law, respecting the provisions, without any of the basis to give people the information that's needed based on the science. And unfortunately, now there's a lot of misinformation on the net, which leads people to believe that, oh, you know, it's just a flu. It's not a big deal. We don't have to wear our masks in public and all of those things. People are not social distancing. Many do not wear masks. It's appeared that the authorities perhaps have focused more on policing the expats living here and the foreigners trapped who are really, for the most part, complying with the protocols rather than the many Moroccans. So it raises the concern about whether another wave or spike will be occurring as deconfinement progresses. And of course, the danger of contracting it is still real.
Are there any special issues or challenges facing Morocco, especially the economic challenge?
Probably the hugest challenge is restarting the economy, as you point out. And again, the tourism sector is vital. There's a focus now. There is at least a plan from the Ministry of Tourism that talks about going forward and focusing on internal tourism, because obviously the international borders are still not open and there's no date expected for that. So what we're talking about is, as Zone 1 opens up and as Zone 2 will gradually open up, how does the Moroccan government encourage the local tourism? Well, local tourism only gets you so far, because typically local Moroccan tourists don't need guides. And one of the major sectors in the tourism industry is the guide industry. Those people have been the very hardest hit, and it's not likely that they'll be used with Moroccan tourists who come. Impact on the hotel industry, the restaurant industry has been immense, especially the small businesses. Another impact I see that Morocco is going to have to be facing, as most countries are, but I think it's particularly important with a healthcare that has major challenges, is the impact on people's mental health. It's very, very clear that people have been impacted by having to stay home in close quarters, many families in just one residence in small neighborhoods, and there is a realization now about that in the government. I also want to say the impact on children is an ongoing concern. One of the big concerns is treating people with the COVID-19 by the use of aggressive treatment with drugs, the long-term effects of which are still unknown. In Morocco, this treatment has included high dosages of hydroxychloroquine along with antibiotics. Now, according to the official numbers, there are 8,000 of those people now, 8,000 people who have recovered from COVID-19. But what's really not known is the long-term after effects of these experimental treatments that actually patients here have been given in high dosages without their consent. So I think looking ahead, it seems to me apparent that the gradual deconfinement by zone and by sector that started in here in Morocco on June the 11th, it raises concerns that need to be addressed, mental health, ongoing care of the people who have had COVID-19. And I also think that because people are basically just tired of it.
That was Elizabeth Mayers, a U.S. law professor living in Morocco and founding editor of Inside Arabia News, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Zimbabwe's central bank has scrapped its currency peg to the U.S. dollar and created a new trading system. At the same time, the Reserve Bank is clamping down on foreign currency dealers it blames for the local currency's free fall in the past few weeks. Adigando in Bulawayo gives us more.
The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe last week announced a new foreign exchange auction system in a bid to foster what the bank calls transparency and efficiency in currency trade. The auction system, which begins this week, is one of a raft of measures the central bank has taken over the past 2 years to create a working foreign currency trading system. The auction ends the intermarket fixed rate of 25 Zimbabwean RTGS dollars to one US dollar, which was introduced in March. Despite the fixed rate, the RTGS dollar has been in free fall in local trading, falling to between 80 and 90 to the US dollar. In the new system, the average of the highest and the lowest allotted bids in the auction becomes the prevailing daily rate for the U.S. dollar. The central bank will hold auctions every Tuesday and bidders will be permitted to make one bid a day. The new measure uses Reuters' foreign currency auction system, which is linked to export payments and exchange control platforms. For a bidder to qualify, they must have a minimum of US$50,000 and a maximum of US$500,000 for each auction. Economic analysts say the new system might falter in the long run as it excludes the millions of informally employed workers. Dumisani Sibanda is among those who have doubts.
We have already come up with a discriminatory policy. There's a barrier of entry into the auction market where you are saying that you are starting at US$50,000. At what exchange rate? If you use the exchange rate of 40, 50, 60, 80, and say how much local currency is required to be able to qualify, it's already coming up with exclusivity, where only a few economic players can participate. So the rest of the economy, and we know the rest of the economy, 80% of the economy is in the informal sector, and that whole 80% of the populace, or 90%, whatever the number. You are saying they should find their money elsewhere outside of the formal system. You are not finding ways of streamlining so that the informal economy participates in formally getting the currency they need to do their business. So it's an exclusive policy, and because of that, it won't be sustainable. It will just work for a few months or whatever, and it will crash as well.
Economic analysts say similar systems have been tried in countries such as Ghana and Egypt, but that those economies are more transparent than is Zimbabwe's. Sibanda also says the central bank is looking at the wrong area in its efforts to help revive the failing economy.
The whole problem of this economy is that we are focusing on buying and selling money. It's continuously around money, buying and selling of money. There's no concrete policy that comes to support the revival of the productive capabilities of the economy. So the revival of the capabilities of production, which is what matters. And we can focus on buying and selling goods and services, not buying and selling money.
Complicating matters for consumers who need U.S. dollars, last week the Reserve Bank said it would target small-scale foreign currency traders who trade informally, and they have been publishing raids on social media platforms such as WhatsApp. Those who violate the ban will face criminal prosecution and other penalties. Many people are angry over the new order, which criminalizes passive membership in WhatsApp groups where dealers post parallel market rates. Ketwe Sibanda is a political analyst in Bulawayo.
This problem of forex was created by the government through the RPZ. We were in this mess because of a disorganized government. Secondly, you find government entities and subsidies actually using the daily rate. No, they're not using the intermarket rate of $25 for the US. When you're buying a three-piece, you're charged according to the black market rate. So the hypocrisy of the government and its institutions is seen that there's no willpower for monetary change by ZANU.
Attorney Dumisani Dube in Bulawayo also doubts the legality of the ban.
No, in my view, I think the Financial Intelligence Unit is overreaching its powers. because the right of access to information is an important principle of democracy. Even our constitution provides for the enjoyment of this right, subject to reviews by legislation such as Official Secrets Act or Interception of Communications Act and POSA and some sections of IPA, which limit this right.
Economic analysts Banda and others say the central bank's latest moves will drive the informal foreign currency market further underground rather than exterminate it. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyesu Uhib in Washington.